This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series.
Kate, you're looking very well.
So I look better than I sound?
Yeah, you sound a bit husky.
I've been working on this husky voice for years, Catherine Collette.
Oh, it's the time, effort and investment has paid off. Things have not gone quite according to plan for you, have they?
They have not. What's happened? I have COVID. I have COVID as we speak. You know, it really makes me laugh though, because I'm feeling better enough today to be sitting up and not in bed, and I can think straight a little bit. Like that we've spent how many years? 2 years, like trying not to get this bloody thing. And then it just comes and it's whatever. You're like, oh yeah, I've got COVID now. Like just complete about face in the brain. It's so strange. But yes, we have a whole house full of COVID, in fact. Quarantine zone.
Are the kids, like, I feel like I've heard experiences from parents where the parents are really knocked out, but the kids are sort of maybe down for a couple of days and then wanting to bake cakes.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened. So I got one day, and really those days were at the end of camping and the trip home where they kind of snuggled. And then they were up and running while Adam and I just fell into bed for 3 days and kind of did not move. So yes, there has been baking, jelly. We're up to the stage of when you were a kid, did you like really invest time and energy into the like change your room around day?
Oh, I was about to say, as you were saying that, I was like, yeah. Rearrange bedroom, rearrange. Which is great for half the time.
Great. But also then inevitably ends up with the, whichever child has decided to do this delightful room, you know, two parent investment in helping this while laying on the bed kind of thing. And then just piles of shit in the hallway and on the balcony that they no longer want, that then one has to decide what to ethically and sustainably and emotionally do with. Anyway, that's been this week. It feels very strange to be just in the house again with the four of us, because life really clocked back up into, you know, something every night of the week, and we've just been away, which was a godsend really, I must say, that we had a week camping. We got COVID while we were camping. So,
but you know, did miss out on Newcastle Writers Festival.
I did. And you know, I was so disappointed because, you know, I really love festivals. And I was so looking forward to this one, and I haven't really had to cancel any before. So also like maybe it was my turn. Okay. Maybe it was my turn, because I haven't had to miss out on many yet, except for the whole year where there were no festivals. but yeah, it sucked a bit. I couldn't really look at, I had to kind of.
Yeah. Turn
mute
off.
Mute my socials.
Not to dwell, but what is the most disappointing part if you had to distill it?
I was hosting an In Conversation one-on-one with Emily Bitto about her new book, Wild Abandon, which I had just finished reading while I was camping, and I was so blown away by it and really interested in the structure and the way she did it and the story and writing the masculine and so much stuff. So I was, you know, when you're just really up for a conversation, like when you're really interested in actually asking the questions and finding out the answers. So that was really disappointing that I didn't get to talk to Emily. And it was going to be a road trip. So the gorgeous Ashley Collegian Blunt, who I know you got to hang out with, and Petronella McGovern and Anna Downs, we were road tripping from Sydney Airport up to Newcastle together. And then I don't know that that's necessarily a very long road trip. I'm not very good with the geography of New South Wales, but then we were going to hang out. You know, I had lots
it's
of
not, but it would be a
coffees and
joy
wines and cocktails, et cetera, planned with people. I think maybe Jock Sarong was bringing my boot back. You know, there was a lot going on. But anyway, next festival, right? It looked like it was an incredible festival. Lots of congrats on the programming to Rosemary Milson, who is the programming director. And
can I say your face does not, like, you're making congratulatory noises, but that's about as unfriendly looking a congratulations as I have ever seen.
My festival frocks did not get a workout, all right? Oh, that's all I'm saying.
Brutal. Has there been a good bit about being offline for a week? What is that naive to even suggest?
Well, you know, like, I wish I had been completely offline. I really couldn't engage because I couldn't make words come out of my head in the right order. But I did do a lot of scrolling, which, of course, scrolling when you're feeling miserable and in bed is so utterly counterproductive and shit, because you feel like you're falling behind and you should be writing and you should be doing things, and you should, at very least, because now you've got this ISO time, you should at very least be getting through the TBR pile next to the bed. But honestly, I could not read. I couldn't make sentences work in my head. So I really should have just switched off completely to socials and email and everything else. That would have been a very smart move at the start of the week, one that I did not
take on board. Torture yourself.
I did. Instead. I chose to torture myself. But I am, you know what? It did make me realize. It made me realize how those things do make me sometimes feel wretched, and that I have to be much more disciplined this year about having times off the socials, as much as I love them.
That's an excellent goal. We're going to take a break now and head into our featured book section.
Born and raised in Tokyo, Catherine Tamiko Argyle is a Japanese-British-Australian arts journalist and author. She migrated from London to Adelaide in 2008, where she now lives beside the sea. A graduate of Cambridge University, she has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Adelaide. Her award-winning short stories have been published in anthologies in the UK and in Australia, and her debut novel, The Things She Owned, was published in 2020. Catherine Tamiko Argyle's second book is Meshi, a personal history of Japanese food, published by Affirm Press. Welcome, Catherine. Congratulations on the launch of your second book, Meshi, a personal history of Japanese food. Tell us, what is this book and where did the concept come from?
Thank you, Kate. It's lovely to be chatting to you. The book really was supposed to be an interim book between my first novel, The Things She Owned, and the novel that's coming next. And I really wanted to encapsulate all the memories I had of growing up in Japan, in Tokyo, where I was born, with a food crazy family. And I really wanted to try and convey what it felt like to be just in a completely different world and what it means to really enjoy and cook Japanese food, because it has far more meaning than just nutrition. And as we know, for every culture, food carries all these memories for us. And I just wanted a trip down memory lane, but it turned out to be a bit different from what I expected.
I've just been reading some of it, but I haven't been lucky enough yet to hold a copy in my hands. You were just showing me the beautiful production that it is, which includes kind of chapters of memoir. It's got your own artwork, your own lino cuts in there, and of course the recipes as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the structure of the book itself?
Yeah, I do quickly want to say I am just so grateful to Affirm Press for the absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous production, the cover by Lisa White. But inside, yes, I have 24 liner cuts, each of which represent what are called seki. They're the ancient lunar solar Chinese calendar, actually, that Japan adopted in the 9th century. And within each seki, of the 24 seki, there are three core. So these are micro seasons. There's a total of 72 micro seasons. And it goes chronologically through the year. And I have cut liner cuts that represent things that I've written about within that time of year, the things that I remember. The actual festivals and things that occur at that time in Japan, the foods that are in season at the time. And then after each chapter, there are just a little handful of recipes that have come from family, family cookbooks and other basic, actually really basic things that a lot of people here and in the UK tell me they're not sure how to do, like, how do you steam rice, Japanese rice, properly? That sort of thing. How to make a really good bowl of miso shiru, miso soup, you know, which isn't always done the right way. So it's just a little hybrid, like me, actually. It's a little hybrid collection of, you know, why we eat the way we do in Japan, the rituals, the seasons, the festivals, and then some stories from my childhood. Some of them are sad, but some of them are really funny as well. So it's a little bit of everything, meshi.
You said to me in an email, Catherine, writing meshi was earth-shaking and transformative in the most unexpected ways. Can you tell us about how writing this book has changed you?
I think many writers will agree with me that whether it's fiction or nonfiction, when you write, something changes deep inside. And for me personally, this book, I'd always found it tremendously painful to revisit Japan in my memories, because there was quite a wrench, really, when I was sent off to boarding school. I was 11 years old. I'd been born and raised in Tokyo, really like a Japanese kid. So I didn't speak English until I was 5. My friends were all there. My family was there. And I felt like I had this deeply Japanese sensibility. Then I was dispatched to a North Yorkshire English school in 1978. Can you imagine what the food was like? And I think in order to survive, you know, our mechanism for survival is to kind of put up a wall or to push back the things that feel uncomfortable. And the separation was so traumatic, I realized that I'd suppressed a lot of memories. And as I started writing what I thought would be a fairly straightforward book of funny anecdotes from my family and a few stories about Japanese food philosophy and a few recipes, what actually came up were memories that I had completely forgotten, that sort of rose up, and the feelings associated with separating. So emotionally, it was an incredibly charged process that I actually feel was necessary to kind of reintegrate this lost part of myself, this Japanese part of myself that I'd left behind all those years ago.
I know that there is a beautiful quote from the US writer Sarah Centilles on the cover of your book. And you and I have actually met before in the beautiful space that Sarah creates in the Word Cave, where you have been working on this book. Can you tell us a little bit about the writing process of this book and how you got it done, how long it took you?
Well, I mean, just coming back to Sarah, I feel tremendously honored to have a quote from her on the front cover, because I am sure, as you do, admire and respect her enormously. And her process of guiding us through generative exercises was actually utterly fundamental to me being able to write this book, because if I had tried to analyze what I was going to write and think about it too hard, I think I would have run away from it because it was so painful. And so using this generative process and writing to see what came was quite freeing. And I'll tell you now, I think I must have written about 120,000 words to begin with and ditched probably over half of that. And those were words that needed to come out, really, like an unplugging to get to the more publishable things that arose. And I think Word Caving with you, which was just wonderful, and, you know, being guided by Sarah, I think without that I would have found it even harder than it already was.
There is an extraordinary kind of sensory experience in reading this work, the memories of you as a little girl. I'm thinking of some of those walking through the cherry blossoms and you eating. The descriptions of food in this book are extraordinary. Have you got a favorite or very particularly significant recipe that you can tell us about that from the book?
Oh, it's so hard to
I
choose,
can only imagine.
It's probably like being asked who's your favourite child.
I should have just said go alphabetically.
I think I'm going to pick, because we're sort of about to enter that season here in Australia of autumn, winter. It doesn't feel like it today. It's lovely and sunny. But there's a dish actually that I dreamt about not long after my mother died. And it was such a significant dream because we shared, it was, as all dreams are, a bit odd and surreal. We were in nighttime Tokyo. We met in an odd little quiet room above a train station in Japan and we didn't speak at all, but we were at a table sharing in a dish called nabe, yose nabe, which is hot pot essentially. And it's really quite easy to prepare. Each family has a different way of preparing yose nabe. So essentially it's a beautiful, I still have my mother's donabe, it's an earthenware pot with a lid that you put over one of those little gas burners on the table. And then you have all these different ingredients that you dunk in there. The broth is seasoned, you know, it's a dashi stock with seaweed, kombu and things like that. And you will cook as you go. So it's a bit DIY, you know, like fondue or any other sort of communal dish. It's something quite heartfelt in that you're sharing and making the food as you go. And you dunk specifically with the yose nabe my mother made. I don't eat pork so much now, but it's paper thin slices of pork and everything from wombok Chinese cabbage and enoki mushrooms, konnyaku jelly noodles, spring onion, all kinds of vegetables. And you dunk in, and when it's ready, you dip out, take out what you want, and you dunk it into a sauce. There were two sauces. So one is a ground sesame savory sauce, and the other one is a slightly tangy yuzu based sauce with soy sauce. And I'm kind of getting very hungry just talking about it.
As am I.
But, you know, my mother and I sharing this in the dream, I think it was one of the last dreams I had of her kind of living in my dream. And it was a sort of highly significant. So I'm going to pick yose nabe, and how to make it and how to adapt it is in the book as well.
Obviously, we've got so many writers who listen to this podcast. Is there some writing advice maybe that you've received or that you've come to know that you can pass on to our listeners, please?
Oh, I would say keep on keeping on, right? What was the motto that we often repeated in Word Cave? Forward, forward, finish.
Forward, forward, finish. Yes.
Because being plagued by doubt sometimes means maybe there's a huge breakthrough about to come and you just have to keep believing in what you're writing and keep going.
Catherine, can you please recommend a book for our listeners?
Yes, I've been reading a lot of English translations of Japanese books, and particularly of female writers. It's an absolute joy. Reading Kawakami Mieko, actually it would be the other way around in English, Mieko Kawakami's Breasts and Eggs, was extraordinary because it shows you a little kind of strata of society that's rarely been kind of, you know, visible outside of Japan. And this is specifically female and of a sort of more disadvantaged economic class. The writing is extraordinary. Sambat's translation is fabulous. I loved that book, and it has won all sorts of awards, been shortlisted for things. So I would recommend that if you'd like to see a little snippet of what it is to be in this rather, you know, outsider social class as a woman in Japan.
Wonderful. Thank you. Catherine, I know that this meshi is just going to be loved by booksellers. I'm sure it's such a perfect gift book. It looks absolutely stunning. I can imagine it flying off the shelves both for food lovers and for things like Mother's Day, which is coming up. Are you going to be out and about celebrating this book and doing events? Is there anything that we can tell our listeners about?
Yes, well, I'm actually going to be coming to Sydney to do a talk at Roaring Stories in Balmain. That's on the 28th of April.
Fantastic.
And here in Adelaide, I'll be doing a literary luncheon actually for Tasting Australia at the beginning of May. So I'll be posting those things as they come up on my social media.
Wonderful. And we'll put links in our show notes as well. Catherine Tamiko Argyle, it's been an absolute joy to speak with you, even for so brief a time. Thank you so much for speaking with us about your beautiful new book, Meshi, and may it just continue to fly off shelves.
Oh, my pleasure, Kate. It's been lovely chatting to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Kate, one of the impacts of COVID and the change in the way that we've done the pod is that we used to always meet up, the two of us. We would have Oh my gosh. It seems weird to even think of now, but we would have at least one guest. Sometimes we would go all that way, roll our cookies all the way to town for one guest.
I know.
But often we would have two.
Seems crazy now.
Very occasionally we would have three. And the cool part of that, I think, aside from both getting to meet whoever was coming on the show, was that the other person would listen to the conversation live. So it was this cool experience where you would be sitting just watching two people have a conversation. Now that doesn't happen. And so the person who does the interview knows what the interview is about, but the other person just listens to it when the episode comes
out. With everyone else.
Yeah, it's weird. It feels weird. Very weird. And sometimes people have said things to me and I haven't listened to it yet.
Yeah.
Anyway, all this is a long-winded introduction to saying the Tony Burch interview was so good.
Oh, I'm so glad. He's such a good interview. Like, you can't really interview Tony Burch badly.
Well, I loved this thing that he said, I don't know if you remember, about tuning.
Yes.
And he sort of gave this orchestra analogy of I don't know what instrument they played, but they asked for a note and then they would tune the instrument to the note. And once they had the note, they would just go. And so he said for short stories, it's really easy to have the note or the tone or the pitch, but with a longer piece, you have to keep tuning. Yes. And I love that idea. It's such a, I think a lot of people do talk about a particular sentence or paragraph that is really grounding and encapsulates the voice. But I love this idea of a note.
Yeah, I thought that was so good. And a couple of times when I've been doing reading stuff for uni, I've like circled something and said, compare with Tony Burch talking about tuning, because it you know, it is that idea of even getting a run up into the right voice or things like that, and then being able to write, say if you can get a short story out, I don't know, your first draft out within a week, you know, being able to hold that note for that time. I think it's so interesting.
It's like a reorient too, isn't it? You stray, you come back. You stray, yeah. You know, you come
well,
back.
Well, that's that idea too of who says about touching the dough, pricking the dough? Who is that? You know, to have you, basically you've got to get your hands in your writing every day, or just to touch it so that it knows that you're there and you know that it's there. Like, I've had a bit of a break now and I feel so far away from my manuscript. I need to get my hands dirty again.
I love that. Did you have an article that you wanted to share?
I do. And this came to me through Rose Michael, who's at RMIT. And she said, oh, Kate, have you read this in Overland? It's an article by Eva Budalka. I think that's the right pronunciation, called Against Efficiency in Overland. And we'll link to this. And Rose recommended it because it's relevant for my novel. Like, it's about, you know, the rise and rise of productivity and efficiency, but it also goes back into Taylorism and factory work and where we got this obsession with productivity and time management. So that's all stuff that I'm writing about. Also, I'm kind of obsessed with that. Like, that's why I wanted so much to talk to Madeline Dorr, who we interviewed at the start of this season or in January with her new book, I Didn't Do the Thing Today, and also that Oliver Berkman 4,000 Weeks. Like, I'm obsessed with this anti-productivity stuff after being a productivity hacker myself. But I thought the article's terrific. It's a great kind of primer for people who are just coming into this subject. So it's got a lot of links to articles, kind of post-pandemic work habits, the way our time is hacked all the time by both our work and then other people who want our time, you know, mindfulness apps and exercise apps and all those things as well. But it's also got then links back to those earlier texts on Taylorism and stuff like that, which I think are really interesting. But the question that she kind of asks is, what is all this efficiency for? Like, why and whom are we doing it for? Is this the right way to live? And I just think it's an excellent one. It's a good reminder. And I think it's, you have to think about it in a different way when you're freelancing, whatever we call ourselves, in creative careers, you know, about how you actually work with your time and if you're going to spend time reading or thinking, you know, how are you putting that into your productivity map, etc. Really good one. Made me think a lot. So I encourage you to read. So what else you've been reading, watching? I promise you I have more watching tips than anything else, and then you will have this week, because I have spent so much time in front of the television. Go.
Can I just tell you, I nearly stepped on a snake today in Preston. Yeah. My friend and I went for a walk, and both of us stepped over the snake, not seeing it, on the nature strip at the same time. A big snake.
On the nature strip?
On the nature strip in Preston. So weird. And we stepped over it, and both of us just screamed, and the snake didn't move, and we ran up the street, and then I was happy just to keep walking and never return. But the friend of mine, Kasia, just started screaming to some workmen who were not even anywhere near the snake. We're on like three houses down across the road that there was a snake. Anyone, one of them felt sorry enough for us that he came and looked at the snake. And his first response, as he's got this sort of, I don't know what he was going to do with a rake, but he had this rake with him. And he was like, oh, no, it's dead. And then he jabbed it, and it wasn't dead at all. And it started moving, but it had been sliced in half, which is probably why, yeah. So it was still alive, and it managed to slither off, and he very, very cruelly started screaming, it's coming after you. It's
oh, my gosh. Oh, my God.
So mean. And we ran off. But I feel really unsettled by it. Now, even sitting in this desk, I'm like, oh, snakes, gross.
That feels like a very city slicker experience. When we were down at Rosebud on the, when was the last long weekend, there was a guy and his son, a man and a small child, who had a massive python with them, like massive, massive python on the beach. And people were kind of looking.
As a pet.
Like around his neck. People so who've been to Rosebud, listeners, please let us know if you've seen the snake guy at Rosebud. He was near the pier. And then so everyone was kind of like, whoa, look at that amazing python or guy with snake. And then the kid took it into the water and was kind of playing with it in the water. It was so freaky and weird. Yeah, I know, right? Snake stories.
God, I don't know how I feel about that. Okay. Reading. I have been on a delightful historical fiction bent, which has been so nice. I like historical fiction, but it just doesn't come my way that often. My mum gave me Kate Quinn. Kate Quinn is an American writer. Her book called The Rose Code. It's a cracker. It's actually a great gift book, I reckon, which should be a category of book. But it's set World War II, three women who are friends, and they're also code breakers.
Oh, I love a code breaking story.
Love it. Love it. There's a bit of romance. It's extremely long. it was one of those ones that you just like have this insatiable appetite for. It was fantastic. Loved it so much that then I went to the library and got The Alice Network, which also set in World War II, similar, I mean, very different premise, but similar stuff around war and spying and espionage in general. So I love those. And then I read, because I'm interviewing her soon, Natasha Lester's latest book, The Riviera House, and it is not only just as good as Kate Quinn's stuff, I reckon it's even better.
It's such good
historical fiction. Very
when
different.
When you say, hold there, I'm gonna take you on this. When you say such good historical fiction, what is it? Can you like pull out a couple of things that are making you really enjoy this writing or Natasha's writing specifically at the moment?
I think they're really pacey plots. Yeah. I mean, you could kind of imagine the visual for the cover of both of these books. Like, they feel very female, very female doing unusual things in wars and quite unexpected sort of stuff in wars. I think the research is really good because it's not only research of detail, like the type of things people wore, the I don't know, the food they're eating, that sort of stuff, but it is just the stories embedded within historic events. And I always think that is a really interesting thing to include, which you can do or can not do. Like, you can have completely fictitious fictitious-y events within war, or you can have semi-real ones as well. Yeah. And I think it's nice to hear a love story.
It's nice to hear a love story.
Things that deliver in terms of, you know, two people meet, their love is thwarted somehow, there's a misunderstanding. It's nice. And I think it's also just that feeling of knowing everything is going to turn out in the end.
Yeah, there's a great comfort in that. I mean, that's why those books sell hundreds and thousands of copies as well, because there is that's what people say about knowing the beats of crime or romance or those type of historical fiction novels. Readers want this. They don't want the rug pulled from under them. They want pacey, they want twists, they want interesting, they want smart, but they want to know that it's all going to turn out okay. And I think that's
There's something so comforting about it. So I have loved those books. The other one is Australiana, and I know this is at least on your bookshelf.
I've started reading it this week because obviously I will have finished reading it by the time this comes out, because we will have spoken to Yumna Kassab about this book.
So this is set in Australia. It is, what I love about it is, and it sort of has a different structure because it's divided into parts, but some parts are interlinked short stories. I'm so obsessed with the interlinked short story concept. So you sort of have this rural town, and rather than tell the story of it over time, it's like a story that goes out. So you have a person walking down the street and does something and sees another person and thinks of them in a certain way, and then it picks up from that person's point of view. I'm so into that as a way of doing something.
I'm only about halfway through, but I definitely had the sense of it almost like a drone circling very slowly around the town and kind of coming back around and just hearing snippets over each household as it goes, you know, and the way it's connected. Very cool structure. It's very interesting.
It's just cool around perception too, isn't it? Like the way you are anchored in your point of view when you interpret what someone is doing or why they're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kate, what have you been reading, or has no reading been happening?
No, so I finished a couple while I was on the beach, which was wonderful. I finished Hovering by Rhett Davis, which I'd been reading and loving. Have you read it yet?
No, but this is the Victorian unpublished manuscript winner.
Yeah. And it's such a cool and interesting book, multi-perspective. It's about the town of Fraser, which is moving and changing, as in people wake up in the morning and the streets have changed directions, or their house isn't where it's meant to be. And I mean, it's about so many more things than that, but it's just a really, really interesting, thought-provoking kind of premise, I suppose, for the book. The writing is really strong and interesting. And, you know, it made me think, we've got our interview with Bernadette Brennan coming up, and she was talking about being on the Miles Franklin judging panel for the last four years, maybe.
Do you think that would be fun or not fun? I guess they're all published books. Yeah, okay.
I think not fun, only now because just reading for pressure and making decisions. I mean, some people I'm sure are very good at it and love it. They obviously are. But I asked her to make you'll hear it in the interview, but some broad kind of comments about trends or things that, you know, she might have noticed. And she was commenting that there seemed to be a lack of kind of really experimental, bold and experimental work, I think she says, coming up on the Miles Franklin list, which of course has parameters around it. So that's not to say it's not coming up in publishing in Australia. But really interesting reading Rhett's book, something like Yumna's book, I'm also halfway through Jane Rawson's new book, and A History of Dreams. And, you know, they are really bold and experimental with their kind of genre crossing and their approach. And the fact, I mean, some of those are with smaller publishers, but Hovering isn't. Hovering's with Hachette. So the fact that it's come out, you know, with quite a big mainstream publisher is also really interesting. But, yeah, can highly recommend. Yeah, really, really interesting. Both that and, yeah, loving Jane Rawson's book as well. What about listening? I haven't really been able to listen to anything this week. That hasn't worked for me. What about you?
I've been listening to lots. The main thing I've been listening to is anything I can find on the Will Smith, Chris Rock, Oscar slap. I was obsessed with this.
Have you watched the BTN episode? Because that's the only thing that I've done. But my girls were like, what's this thing? We need to watch this. And so they watched it on Behind the News.
God, that's incredible.
Yeah, you can also do that.
That's a bit like, I think when COVID was first happening, or maybe like right at the start, the ABC had put on an episode of Bluey where I think a hospital was involved. Like it was sort of, it was a lovely
commentary.
Let's explain
this one to the kids.
Yeah, it was really nice. Oh, similar sort of thing. Well, that is one stone that remains unturned. But I have been obsessed with this, really interested in multiple people's takes and how that's evolved. Glennon Doyle, I don't know if you had seen when it first happened, she came out talking about sort of, she had the domestic violence take and that language of love will make you do crazy things and that was problematic. And then you had sort of really respected Black commentators coming out saying, no, the context here is different. And it's about race and the politics of hair. And it like just is so, so fascinating. The best commentary, though, I think, was the Spill podcast, which is part of the Mamma Mia network. They did a 2-episode breakdown. So probably about 40 minutes in total of just in-depth analysis.
Oh my God.
I absolutely loved it. I love that podcast. I don't know that I've mentioned it before. It's hosted by Laura Brodnick and Key Reese, and it is all pop culture. And they're really clever and they have great analysis about all sorts of stuff. But even just another part of it that is lovely is they're two women, I think they're in their late 20s is where I think they are age-wise, not what they say their age, but they have such a cool way of talking that is so young women-y and fast, and I just love it.
Oh my gosh,
I could listen to them all day. It's the sort of, I feel like it's almost the way of talking that would be critiqued at times. Like there's not full vocal fry or anything like that, but it's, they have a particular way of talking that I see as young and female and I love.
Okay, I love that. Are you implying that we don't have this way of talking?
I think we've lost it. Like it feels voyeuristic enough that I can say I'm not that. Do you know what I mean? Like,
is it maybe how we talk at 2 o'clock in the morning when we're with all of our girlfriends?
Maybe. Okay, you've got girlfriends still from high school and stuff.
Yeah. But no one should do a podcast of us at 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you know what I did listen to that got us through a, you know, 1 hour period of the very long road trip to Saltwater Creek? Was I was driving and I just said to Adam, just go on This American Life, like choose anything, choose something that looks interesting. And he chose the blackjack episode about card counting. Oh my goodness. I mean, by the end of it, we were like, surely this is how we're going to be able to make our money now. We will just learn how to count cards. We'll go into casinos and we'll play blackjack until they throw us out. It was very interesting. I do like it.
Good. I have been charged with finding the This American Life episode previously and have a knack for choosing the dullest, blandest. Yeah, I don't know what it is.
The one
because
that,
like anything, it's hit and miss, you know.
Yeah.
Like they do a lot of amazing content, but
they do.
I can find those you know, bits of coal within the gems of
my most recommended is that Feather Heist episode.
I was about to say the Feather Heist is such a good one.
That is just gets me every time. Okay. What have you been watching?
TV, I'm going to do a non-reality recommendation, which
feels
dated already because you had half mentioned it the last show and I know you've watched it, Inventing Anna.
Inventing Anna.
Whoa. Did you love it?
I didn't actually finish it, to tell you the truth. So I went,
oh my God,
really hard on it. I must have been on my own for some reason or something. It wasn't something that we watched together in our house. And then I haven't gone back to finishing it, actually. That's something I could do with the rest of my COVID week. All right,
Carly, we don't watch anything together.
Ever.
Carly doesn't really watch TV. He just, at the moment, he's obsessed with, which I said at my launch. And actually, I said at my launch, Carly's obsessed with Bitcoin and I'm not interested in Bitcoin and I'd like that on the record. And afterwards, he was like, yeah, it's actually crypto. It's not Bitcoin specifically, but he watches so much Bitcoin, like he's obsessed. Anyway, so I have no one to talk to about TV shows. Inventing Anna, you would be living under a rock if you haven't heard of this show about sort of a New York socialite who tricks the New York scene, is actually not what she seems to be. I think what is the most compelling thing about it is that it is based on a true story, but it takes a lot of liberties with the truth, to the extent that every episode you have this sentence that flashes up in different ways saying this whole story is completely true, except for the parts that made up. But of that fiction, non-fiction mix, the aspect that is easily the most interesting vein is this character of Rachel. So all of the people in Anna's life basically are given different names and are amalgamations of people who were her friends and did exist, except for Rachel, who is this person who is portrayed in the most negative, kind of self-interested, money-oriented way. And it's sort of, I don't know what she did to piss off whoever was making this documentary, but I feel like they've gone out of their way.
How much deep diving have you done beyond the watching?
So much.
You need your own side shoot pop culture. I feel like someone needs to put their hand up and say, Catherine, I will do a side shoot of the first time podcast talking pop culture with you, because you just have always know so much more about the things that I'm watching.
I think it's pretty niche. I actually think pop culture is really represented in terms of analysis. It just, yeah, I love it. It's great. So good. But I love this. I would love to know what Rachel did to upset people so much that they have, you know, really gone to town on her.
Someone send us that article, please.
Yeah. TV. Now you should have a long list.
Oh my gosh, I have so much. So I started with, like, on the very first I Am Not Moving From This Bed, where everyone was in, like, kids were set up on the couch. They had their show going. Adam was out for the count. I gave him the studio. He had his show going.
Oh.
Yeah, well, I couldn't be in here because I was like, it's just giving me a panic attack about work.
Yes, yeah.
So I did Bridgerton season 2.
Oh, is it good?
Oh my God, I loved it so much. And I was scared because I was like, I don't know if it is going to live up to the feels of season 1, and it totally does, and it's great. Although I have seen, like, no spoilers here, but I've seen a bit of commentary on a couple of things that there was a promise that was given in season 1. Like, for instance, let's just be general on kind of like Eloise's sexuality, for instance. And that hasn't necessarily come through. Anyway, I'm not like a total Bridgerton diehard fan. So and I haven't done all the reading on the commentary, Catherine, I must say.
It does. You can answer this question, though. Does it pick up where the last one left off? Is it time?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. It's the next season. Yeah. But yeah. I was trying to find for my sister, who's a diehard romantic, has already watched the whole season. There's this very specific scene where one character is giving, you know, his kind of like, this is the moment of that everything's been leading to, the full sexual tension kind of library.
They do sex, don't they?
Oh, like, my gosh, they do. And they've got that amazing intimacy coordinator as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, and the line involves lots of things, but he then says, you know, basically, you are the bane of my existence and the object of all my desires. And when I was trying to find that on Instagram to send to my sister, the bane of my existence and the object of all my desires as like a hashtag is already up like thousands and thousands and thousands of times.
Oh my God,
it is just
hilarious.
It's like, it's the moment, right? It's like what everyone wants said to them all the time. Anyway, for my sister and I, who, you know, are deep tragics, who kind of our bones were formed via Pride and Prejudice and Mr. Darcy and Anne Gilbert in Anne of Green Gables and the rest of it. Something like Bridgerton is amazing. So I did Bridgerton. Alice Robinson, amazing, recommended to me Yellow Jackets. Have you heard about Yellow Jackets?
Not even heard about it.
Oh, my Lord. I think you will like this. Brand new. I haven't finished the season yet. It's on one of the ones, just get a free trial and plow through it. Maybe HBO, I think it is.
Oh, I'm not a member of HBO.
It's. I think you get it through maybe it's Paramount through Prime. I'm not sure how you get it. Anyway, it's basically Lord of the Flies but girls. It's a high school soccer team, girls soccer team, who go to the Nationals and they are on a plane and it crashes in the wilderness and they have to survive. And it goes between them surviving in the wilderness and the present day with the older characters, one of whom is Christina Ricci, who's amazing.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, and also Juliette Lewis, who is just extraordinary in this particular character. Anyway, it's so good. And as Alice rightly pointed out to me, the narrative structure is really interesting as well in the way that they tell the story. So that's been very cool. But I've had to switch to watching that in the afternoon because it's a little bit scary. So I can't watch that one at night.
What do you mean it's scary? They're not murdering each other or...
Oh. Isn't that an interesting question to ask, Catherine?
Wow.
It has, paranormal as well in the, you know, okay. like in its warnings. Yeah. But I'll let you go and watch it because I think that you'd be quite into it.
Is paranormal a warning now?
Yeah. Oh, well, it's not a warning. It's like in its, why is it MA15 plus, like course language, paranormal themes or supernatural.
That's kind of weird, isn't it?
Maybe. Don't know.
Like who is that triggering, I wonder? What's
scaredy cats like me who can't watch it at night because then they're like, oh, no, I'm the last one up and I'm getting COVID fever dreams and I don't want to think about this anymore.
I remember telling my kids that I'd watched this movie, Candyman.
Oh.
I think I was 14. Candyman, yes. Have you watched it?
Candyman was my first.
Oh, my God.
You know when you bloody did horrible. Parties like, I don't know how they did them where you grew up, but out in the back blocks where we grew up, in about the year seven, that tricky period where obviously back in the day you couldn't necessarily sneak booze anywhere when you were still 12. You weren't drinking it. You'd watch scary movies instead. Yeah, like that would be the scary thing that you did. And that was the first like scary movie party I went to. We watched Candyman. Yeah.
Oh, my God. We did the same thing and then no one could go to the toilet together. We couldn't look in mirrors. Because the thing was if you said Candyman, Candyman, Candyman into the mirror, the Candyman would appear. And
It all comes back in. And my last one, of what I did all in one hit last night, which I reckon you've probably already watched but I haven't yet, and hint, hint, I haven't even told you this, this is partly for research for an upcoming interview for the Masters series, is that I watched 9 Perfect Strangers.
How good's that?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen 9 Perfect Strangers. I've read the book. I've obsessed over the author. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that off air, but that is an upcoming. So 9 Perfect Strangers, that was my first viewing of 9 Perfect Strangers. I was obviously a massive fan of
The Little Lies series.
Yeah. How does it compare? Because I haven't actually read the book. How does it compare to the
It's different series. To the book, actually. I feel like it's got a much darker vibe than the book. The book is lighter and it deviates in terms of particularly that main character that's played by Nicole Kidman into what her motivation is and some of her backstory and stuff.
But interesting.
They're definitely like, I think it's darker.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What I notice with television at the moment, though, is just the bloody budgets, like the lushness of some of these big shows, the something like Bridgerton or something like that, something like 9 Perfect Strangers, just the money behind making them look the way they do with the caliber of, creators on board and actors on board. It's just phenomenal, right?
I think what's nice about 9 Perfect Strangers is there's some Australian actors there too, so it's a lovely mix.
And obviously that weird like, for Australians watching it, it's clearly in Australia. Like, it's clearly filmed in Australia, but it's not meant to be. That was. I wondered if that was disconcerting for US viewers, or if there is, I don't know, a spot that seems a little bit like Byron Bay in the US. I'm imagining there must be somewhere in California. Anyway, there were other things as well, but I've talked too much about television. That's what I've been watching. So what's coming up?
We have
Bendigo Writers Festival on that runs from the 13th to the 15th of May. Catherine's got an event. I've got an event. We've both got an event together, which will be fun. Catherine, you're going to Queenscliff.
Queenscliff will be fun. Queenscliff has a cool thing that has tripped me up a number of times, in that before we got on, Kate was like, "You sure Queenscliff is not the same weekend as Bendigo?" And I have this moment of going, "Holy crap, I've doubled up." But Queenscliff is set across 3 weekends.
Nice.
I am there the final weekend in May with, it's going to be a really good panel, actually. It'll be me, Tony Jordan, and Jackie Byron, who wrote Happy Hour. And Lynn Yewalt is the host, so it'll be nice.
That'll be so much fun. That's the other thing I was devastated on missing out. I had to obviously step out of interviewing Tony Jordan, but the incredible Michelle Wright stepped in at the last moment to host that, as she would do, because she's amazing. Very cool. I want to mention too that I am finally going to get some time to work on the book, because I am doing the week-long Word Cave with Sarah Centilles, which I'm going to put link in for people to have a look at. So it runs from April 28th through to May the 4th. Same kind of system as her normal Word Cave, so people who've done them before, or you've heard me raving about them. And this is the only week-long one. I don't think she's ever done one before, and she's just testing it out, so it's the only one she'll run this year. But, oh, my gosh, I'm already salivating at the thought of it. So I'll put a link to that in our show notes as well. That's it.
We can end.
Yep. My voice will be better next time we speak. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.